you all for coming. This book was a long time in the making. Before it appears in this form, it was my thesis requirement for my doctoral degree in cultural studies at McMaster. And as I learned, a thesis and a book are not the same. First, you have to learn how to speak in academic jargon, and then you have to try and stop speaking in academic jargon. So I'm really grateful to Candida, Jessica, and the whole team at Fernwood for their help and support with this. Thank you. And I didn't try and send it anywhere else. I knew that Fernwood was where it had to go. And I'm really humbled to be a part of their corpus of amazing texts for social change. So go Fernwood. And thanks to the Radical Imagination Project and to Max, who's been a constant source of support and encouragement for me. I also want to thank many people in my community here and in Hamilton who supported me in this work, sometimes just by doing their own work and by continuing to believe that another world is possible. When I began researching this project, I was seeing all the yellow ribbons everywhere and the ramping up of the call to support the troops in many forms, from the bumper stickers to statements of politicians, and I was curious about that. I thought, isn't this an American thing? Where is this coming from? There has to be a history to this kind of cultural politic. So, militarization being the way that a society comes to value militarism and to take it for granted as normal. When we talk about militarization, we mean all the ways that culture comes to incorporate military values, norms, and goals, both explicitly, like support our troops, ribbons under the ice at Major League Hockey games, to implicitly suffuse throughout culture, from entertainment to fashion. It's about making war cool. It was as I was thinking about this, and I was especially thinking about how the government was putting tons of funding into militarizing the War of 1812 celebrations and other commemorative events, that I found this fabulous jacket. Where am I ever going to wear that? At the same time, Canada used to talk a lot about peacekeeping. Certainly, peacekeeping and multiculturalism have been central to Canadian national identity for as long as I can remember, which is to say only about since the end of the Cold War, but I know some of you have longer memories. It turns out, of course, that multiculturalism, as a set of state policies, is complicated, and peacekeeping is kind of a myth, and both of these legacies were used to try and fashion an identity for Canada and its interventions in the world as a kind of global good guy. In reality, a nation state, and especially a colonial settler state, can't be a good guy. It's not in their nature. It's not what they're for. They're inherently made up of various forms of historic and contemporary structural oppression and exclusion. So after 9/11, when Canada decided to participate in the war in Afghanistan, we see those previous ideas of being a nation of peacekeepers and a multicultural society were used to say, hey, Canada knows how to be a good country. We have the moral authority to overthrow other people's governments. I'm being flippant. It's much more detailed in the book. But there's this real tension between the myths of Canadian identity and values on one hand and militarization and neoliberalism on the other. So the book is about how that tension was negotiated in and through Canadian culture, how you militarize a country whose stated values are so antithetical to cultures of militarism, and where the vast majority of people believed that we didn't do that sort of thing. So I chose 6 case studies. The first section looks at new militarizing cultural practices. So these are things like the Yellow Ribbon campaign to support the troops, which I'm sure you've all seen bumper stickers, the Red Fridays campaign, which is about wearing red on Fridays to show support for troops, and mostly that tended to stay around military bases and in communities around bases. And the Highway of Heroes memorializing practice, where the remains of soldiers who were killed in Afghanistan were repatriated along the 401 highway in Ontario, and people would line the highway to show their respect. So that's the first section. And then in the second section, I look at cultural texts that have been produced that I think are emblematic of what's going on here. And the first one I chose was the Canadian Forces rebranding of itself through their recruitment ads and recruitment strategies. And the last wave of recruitment, the last branding campaign was, there's no life like it. These images of, like, there's a guy in a canoe, and it's very, like, Canadian wildernessy. and compare that to this one, right, which is about fight fear, fight chaos, fight with the Canadian forces. And then the third one of those is I looked at Paul Gross's 2008 film Passchendaele as really emblematizing a whole bunch of tendencies in the cultural production of militarization in Canada at the moment. From how culture is produced to how something that's explicitly about the past can be implicitly about the present too. So I'm going to read a passage from the book, two passages actually, and then I'm just going to say a little bit more about support our troops culture, and then we can open it up for discussion. I make that sound like I'm going to be brief, it's not true. The idea that the last decade has seen a massive shift in Canadian culture is now quite widely accepted. The Ottawa Citizen hosted a debate between former military officer and current esteemed University of Ottawa political scientist Paul Robinson and the much lauded Canadian military historian and former York University professor Jack Granitstein on the topic over two consecutive days of July 2011. Both agreed that a transformation had occurred, which Robinson characterized as having highly undesirable consequences, and conversely, Granitstein celebrated as the appropriate and long overdue recognition for a military all but banished from Canadian life. For Robinson, the new militarization of Canadian culture and discourse helped to legitimize the waging of war and to militarize foreign policy, elevates the military into a moral elite of super citizens that damages the structure of civil-military relations, and skews government spending priorities toward military ends. Granitstein, in contrast, argued that we have soldiers to thank for the very freedom to criticize militarization in the first place, and he quoted a high imperialist Rudyard Kipling poem to suggest that Canadian culture and society would benefit from this militarist shift in priorities. Among the centerpieces of Harper's self-styled new government agenda is the unprecedented 20-year, $492 billion Canada First Defense Strategy, a modern military for the 21st century, first introduced in the 2008 budget. The report mobilized the image of brave Canadian soldiers dutifully accepting their orders despite being woefully undersupplied, and promised to reverse the decline of the Canadian Armed Forces. This became a key pedagogical moment for the government to link military spending to neoliberal austerity and a purposefully slippery notion of Canadian values. The warfare or security state, as many scholars have noted, is not more fiscally responsible or tight-fisted than the welfare state. Where in the most socialist-leaning moments in Canadian history could one find such grandiose plans for government spending? Against claims that military spending has been left to languish, Bill Robinson writes, "Canadian military spending is not low, whether measured in terms of absolute spending, economic burden, or historical trend. Canada is currently spending more on the military than it has at any time since the end of the Second World War. While the practical difficulties of achieving this level of military spending this rapidly have necessitated a slightly tempered projection of these increases, there's no doubt that military spending will continue to increase over the life of the CFDS plan, the Canada First plan. Canada's military budget, creeping in the upper teens of billions over the past decade, stood conservatively at a conservatively estimated $22.3 billion for fiscal year 2010-2011. The Canada First Defense Strategy is, in fact, a key component of the conservative plan for Canada's economic future. The vast expansion of military spending, funding for military research, and the development of military infrastructure across the country heralds the bolstering of the Canadian military-industrial complex as the economic salvation of the nation. The renewed relationship between the Canadian forces, the defense industry, and research and development organizations that the CFDS marshals into effect entails streamlined protocols for the procurement of defense contracts, greater industry consultation, and a revised industrial benefits policy aimed at encouraging industry to make long-term investments in Canada. The plan claims that Canadians will benefit from this transfer of wealth from the public coffers to the military and its private partners via the creation of high-tech, high-value, sustainable jobs in all regions, directly through the development of military capabilities and indirectly through technological spin-offs and commercial applications, which will put Canadians to work protecting Canadians. Indeed, the plan foresees the deep implication of Canadian institutions like universities in this corporate-led, publicly subsidized militarization of the Canadian economy, as other sources of research funding are cut or left to atrophy. While the report relies largely on euphemism and implication, the overall message is clear. In prioritizing NATO and NORAD, the CFDS outlines the Harper government's vision of Canada's future as an eager, if junior, participant in a neoliberal American empire, and one in which bolstering a military-industrial complex by courting American arms manufacturing subsidiaries takes the place of supporting domestic industries. The very title of Canada First Defense Strategy recalls the cultural tradition of the popular Canada First Club and social movement of the post-Confederation era, founded in 1868 and active through the 1870s. Boasting a weekly Toronto paper called The Nation, a club called the National Club, and a political party called the National Association, the Canada First movement gained widespread public influence, espousing a nationalist platform that included whites-only immigration, along with ideas of male suffrage and a preferential national industry program. A lobby group for the interests of the elite in the new nation of Canada, the Canada First movement espoused a homogeneous pan-British ethnicity as the true or natural Canadian identity, and fomented settler unrest in Upper Canada during the Red River Rebellion, especially after the execution of Thomas Scott, mobilizing racist militias and lynch parties to meet Riel's representatives as they traveled east to negotiate. In addition, the phrase Canada First has had subsequent lives in the Canadian white supremacist and anti-immigration circuit. It would strain credulity to suppose that conservative nationalist advisors in the Harper government could have been unaware of this history, especially considering Harper's mentor and lead advisor, Tom Flanagan, wrote an influential book on the Riel Rebellion and its place in early Canadian politics. It should not be surprising, then, given the historical tradition that it invokes, that the Canada First Defense Strategy marks a cultural as well as a policy shift away from the mythology of peacekeeping to a far-right vision of a military thoroughly integrated into the social fabric and economy of the country and fit to defend unspecified Canadian national interests from a world teeming with external and internal threats. What is surprising is that as a minority government, the Harper administration was able to pass this $500 billion plan with so little public attention. It speaks to the way militarization works at both economic and cultural levels toward broad social transformation. Key to this process in Canada has been the importation and local reinvention of the Yellow Ribbon Campaign and other forms of support our troop culture. So what's the trouble with supporting the troops? Well, first, especially in practices like the Yellow Ribbons, the ambiguity that they contain between demonstrating care and concern for soldiers that are far away and in dangerous circumstances is conflated with endorsing the war, the mission, or the government. This ambiguity isn't coincidence, though. It's intentional, and it's absolutely crucial to how these emblems work and how they curtail public debate through the marshalling of Canadian patriotism and patriotic nationalism. Even some elements of the anti-war movement were drawn into support our troops rhetoric, which might or might not be a good strategy. We can talk about that in the discussion time. For example, in response to Ottawa NDP MP Paul Dewar, who was toting the support our troops, bring them home line at a demonstration against the war, Harper attacked him publicly and said, "You can't say you support our troops and not stand behind the things they do." Interestingly, this is kind of an aside, in Atlantic Canada, which is overrepresented in the military, there was one of the highest rates of supporting the troops and also one of the highest rates of opposing the war, showing that I think Atlantic Canadians are no fools. They know what's going on. But second, what does it even mean to support the troops? It is implied that troops are unsupported. But what exactly qualifies as support? Because it's an American tradition that comes to us via Vietnam, and the connotation of until they all come home, the widespread feeling that troops need support is part of the Yellow Ribbon's legacy. But in Canada, the Canadian context is lacking. I mean, certainly the circumstances of Canadian soldiers are not identical to the circumstances of American soldiers. But even then, the content of what support should mean is purposefully left vague and undefined so that the work of supporting could never be said to be finished. Third, and related, we see the call to support soldiers being used for political ends by governments like Stephen Harper's to skew government funding and cut funding to social programs, transforming Canadian society, at the same time as they slash funding to Veterans Affairs and mishandle veterans' information and all kinds of scandals and reveal to us just how cynical this operation is. Fourth, the call to support the troops displaces civic values with militarist ones. Patriotic nationalism gets in the way of other alternatives when we're thinking about what a society could or should look like. Support our troops culture doesn't just occur in a vacuum, though. It intervenes in Canadian nationalism at a moment when so-called ordinary Canadians are in backlash mode against the perceived gains of multiculturalism, against the welfare state, against what's seen as liberal elements of state policy toward women and toward gender and sexual and racial, any kind of ethnic others, right? After Mary Ellen Campbell, I call that cults of persecuted white masculinity, the sort of, well, Rob Ford is the best example of this. The sort of white dude that feels like he's already been giving up a lot to some sort of other special interest group and who wants to stop giving and celebrate his Euro-Anglo heritage. So I say more, a lot more about that in the book too. But I think in Canada, we really want a story of origins that's about something other than colonialism and the reality of the colonial settler state. So first it was the ready eye, ready loyalty to the United British Empire. And then it was peacekeeping and multiculturalism. And now we're entering an era of Canadian exceptionalism. I think instead of continuing to avoid that reality, which is ongoing, the colonial reality, Canada should cultivate a culture and identity of being treaty people, respecting and honoring the treaties. I think that would be a much better way for us to go. So this is a very slim volume, and because it's focused on identity and culture, I don't really get into the details about the military-industrial complex as much. But I think that's a really crucial part of the defining problem of our times, where we have on one hand Indigenous people reclaiming their rights and responsibilities from coast to coast to coast, and their allies who want to honor the treaties to live in real relationship with the original people and in balance with the land, and on the other hand, as people rise up against these and other forms of oppression, they encounter a state of the full force of the capitalist colonial settler state, which is a warfare state, wedded to securitization and militarization, and with endless resources for surveillance and policing, but no money for daycare. This is the state that is in bed with resource extraction companies that are increasingly threatening not only our communities and our health, or our water, like in Elsipuktuk and Kent County, but are really threatening the survival of human life on the planet. So in the end, I argue that just as the rest of the world is kind of fed up with Americans and their belief that they live in the best country in the world, and whenever something bad happens there, they sort of say, how could this happen? This is America. If that's where we are in Canada right now, too. We can no longer deny that the reality of Canadian foreign and domestic policy, what's actually going on with the economy, and especially the legacies of racism and colonialism, don't match up with stated Canadian values. We have to change that.